New day.
This is April Grace, and you and I are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at kpfk.org.
You never wanna be told the truth. The lies continue. The people suffer. What are we to do? The time is now. We will wait no longer. We decide right now. It's over. We have the power. We know it. We feel
Good evening. It's Monday, August 24th. I'm Lauren Schmidt.
And I'm Christina Onnestad. In tonight's news, the Supreme Court clears the way for President Donald Trump's mail voting executive order ahead of the midterm elections.
And hopefully there will be no corrupt mail-in ballots, which if you watched California and so many other places, mail-in ballots are inherently corrupt.
The U.S. launches what it calls an economic D-Day sanctions campaign against Iran, as Tehran threatens retaliation.
We certainly did not start this war, but we will not allow it to end on terms dictated by the aggressor.
Civilian casualties rise in Gaza as Israel escalates attacks on civilian infrastructure amid Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's re-election campaign.
I am not in the position as a Palestinian to pay the price from the bodies and blood and the life of our people in order to secure the success or the of victory of Netanyahu's election.
Canada prepares to announce retaliatory tariffs against the United States.
The new U.S. tariffs are designed to hurt us and divide us. I warned that America is trying to break us so they can own us. And I promise that that will never, ever happen.
And Western states remain divided over how to share the shrinking Colorado River as federal officials propose new options for managing its dwindling water supply.
The shortages, the reductions from the legal entitlements are going to be quite large, particularly at low flows. And at low reservoir storage. And everyone is going to be feeling the effect of that.
These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Christina Onnestad.
And I'm Lauren Schmidt. The Supreme Court is siding with the Trump administration in a case over President Trump's executive order restricting mail-in voting, though it remains unclear how much can be implemented before the fast-approaching midterm election. AP correspondent Ed Donahue has more.
The Supreme Court is clearing the way for President Trump to move ahead on his executive order restricting mail-in voting. The three liberal-leaning justices on the Supreme Court dissented. Mail balloting has long been a favorite target for the president, who has claimed it breeds fraud despite strong evidence to the contrary and his own use of voting by mail.
The cheating on mail-in voting is legendary. It's horrible what's going on. And it's very clearly covered. Very, very clearly so. I think this will help a lot with elections.
The executive order signed in March calls on the administration to create lists of eligible voters and orders the Postal Service to deliver mail ballots only to people on those lists. The Postal Service laid out how it would implement the order last week, but in just a few weeks, some states will start sending out mail ballots to voters. More court challenges could also slow down the process. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The court's three liberal-leaning justices dissented, with the Honorable Ketanji Brown Jackson writing that the rule, quote, lets another shoe drop in the Kafkaesque nightmare that our precedents have been steadily creating for certain plaintiffs who seek to bring election-related challenges, close quote. New York Attorney General Letitia James foreshadowed more legal fights ahead, calling the decision a painful setback, but vowed it would, quote, not be the final word, close quote. The decision also appears to leave room for additional court challenges that could further slow Trump's order calling for delivery of mail ballots only to people on federal government-created lists. The Supreme Court's conservative majority didn't decide the legality of Trump's order, instead ruling that states who sued did not have the legal right to challenge it. While the emergency order is not final, it does have the potential to create chaos around voting across the country, with Trump often questioning the integrity of elections he does not win, and the nation's highest court, again, the possible arbiter of a political controversy. The court's order opens a path for the administration to begin action to restrict mail voting, but could lead to further litigation that could freeze the federal government. President Donald Trump had warned of new sanctions against Iran, what he calls a, quote, economic D-Day. Today, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced what he calls Operation Economic Outcast, sanctions targeting Iran, as well as countries that trade with it, what Trump calls Iran's enablers. Chief among Iran's trade partners is China, though Bessent avoided naming that country as a target. Iran, however, is pushing back, threatening to target countries that side with the new U.S. sanctions campaign. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
Since the U.S. and Israel launched their war on Iran with a series of decapitation strikes, President Donald Trump has tried a number of different approaches, bomb and missile attacks, beginning with a devastating attack on a girls' school, a naval blockade of Iranian shipping, exchanges of tit-for-tat strikes, all while repeatedly claiming that the U.S. has already won the war. Now, Trump is trying another approach, new sanctions. Trump calls it Economic D-Day. Monday morning, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent unveiled the new campaign.
Today, at President Trump's direction, the United States Treasury has begun Operation Economic Outcast, an unprecedented campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran and its enablers.
He calls it a zero-leakage approach that will, in his words, tighten the noose to block revenues for what he calls the evil Iranian regime.
New sectoral sanctions determinations issued today target five of Iran's most vital lifelines that it exploits in other countries: digital assets, technology, gold, aviation, and shipping.
Iran has some experience with sanctions, having already withstood nearly five decades of U.S. sanctions. Notably, the new sanctions target not only Iran, but other countries that do business with Iran in an attempt to cut off Iran from the global economy.
Those who stand with the United States will reap the rewards of our partnership. Those who tether themselves to the Iranian regime should expect to share in the isolation of a withering regime. Teams from Treasury, State, and the U.S. military are now meeting with their global counterparts to tell them that the United States expects action.
Bessent's announcement was a bit short on details. He did not name the countries that could face potential secondary sanctions for trading with Iran. The Islamic Republic's largest trade partners include Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, and the big one, China. Bessent dodged questions about sanctioning China, but he did say that no one is above the reach of U.S. sanctions, saying, "We know who they are." He added, "When the hammer of U.S. Treasury actions fall upon them, they will have no one to blame but themselves."
As I said, every country, every entity should know that they should be prepared to face U.S. sanctions. And no one is above this. We are going to hold everyone accountable, and this is economic asphyxiation of this regime.
He says he expects a major announcement of a financial institution being sanctioned by the end of this week. But Iran is already pushing back. Ismail Baghaei is a spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry.
ما حتماً شروع کننده جنگ نبودیم، اما
We certainly did not start this war, but we will not allow it to end on terms dictated by the aggressor.
بر اساس شروط طرف متجاوز باشه.
He says trying methods that have already failed will not bring about a different outcome. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Mohsen Rezaei, said that if Trump takes certain actions, Iran will retaliate in a seismic manner. He spoke in an interview with Iran's state broadcaster that aired Saturday.
ما تا حالا به هیچ منافع آمریکا منافع اقتصادی حمله نکردیم. هیچ.
So far we have not attacked any U.S. economic interests. None. We have struck U.S. bases, yes. Why? Because attacks against us were launched from those bases. But if they're going to wage economic sanctions against us, does the United States not have oil companies and other economic interests around Iran and elsewhere? Then we will strike them. Isn't this U.S. economic move in the form of an economic war just another act of foolishness?
As of now, Iran continues to hold a firm grip on shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. That, along with the U.S. blockade against Iran, continue their chokehold on shipping through the strait, wreaking damage on global economies. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Monday that transits through the Strait of Hormuz have come to a near standstill, with high oil prices and sharply rising costs of fertilizers. He says the conflict with Iran, together with the Ukraine-Russia conflict, are choking trade and squeezing the global food system.
And so my appeal is clear. We need full respect for international law, including the law of the sea and international humanitarian law. Protection for civilian shipping, infrastructure, and civilian seafarers. The upholding of navigational rights and freedoms. An immediate end to attacks against commercial shipping and civilian infrastructure in the Black Sea. The full restoration and respect of navigational rights and freedoms in the Strait of Hormuz. And an end to attacks against shipping in the Red Sea and around Bab el-Mandab.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
U.S. forces have struck another vessel in the eastern Pacific, killing two people accused of trafficking drugs. U.S. Southern Command announced the strike today. It's the first in about 2 months. The death toll from the Trump administration's near-year-long campaign of bombing boats off Latin America's Caribbean coast and in the eastern Pacific now exceeds 210 after more than 60 strikes, all without proof of drug laundering. U.S. Southern Command says forces executed a strike on a low-profile vessel operating along established narco-trafficking routes in the eastern Pacific. President Trump has said the U.S. is at war with drug cartels. Critics have questioned the offense's legality. The United Nations has warned of extrajudicial killings.
In Gaza, at least six Palestinians, including a child, were killed this Monday in Israeli attacks across the Strip. That's according to Al Jazeera. Residents said one strike came minutes after they received an Israeli military warning to flee the area. The violence followed airstrikes that killed three Palestinians in central Gaza on Sunday. Among the dead was 4-year-old Mohammed Taha, who was killed in a strike that hit his house in central Gaza. The attacks come as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened to escalate military action over the alleged launching of paper kites from Gaza. In a statement Sunday, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said he had instructed the military to, quote, act immediately and forcefully to prevent balloons, kites, or drones from being launched from Gaza toward nearby Israeli communities. Netanyahu and Katz issued a joint statement threatening severe retaliation and the forced displacement of Palestinians from areas they described as launch sites for kites, drones, and balloons. Al Jazeera further reported that the Israeli military acknowledged that the recovered kites contained no explosives. Military inspections reportedly found 10 paper kites, which had been flown by children living in displacement camps. Palestinian political analyst Hussam Shaheen told Al Jazeera that claims of drones being launched from Gaza are fabricated, stating, quote, it is a false and baseless assertion. It has been denied, and there is no evidence whatsoever to prove any connection to drones, close quote. Shaheen further alleged that the Israeli government is manufacturing a security crisis around children's toys to undermine ceasefire agreements. These latest attacks come 1 week after a U.S. delegation asked Israel to reduce its military operations in Gaza. Instead, it's issued fresh evacuation warnings and subsequent strikes. Like in southern Gaza, that killed 10-year-old Amal Abu Khatir, according to Nasser Hospital. Her relatives wept as they gathered around her body before it was wrapped for burial. Amal's grandmother spoke through tears.
What did you do? You didn't do anything, dear. A girl was eating when she was shot in the back and killed instantly. She died immediately. A little girl, only 10 years old. She hadn't done anything.
The Associated Press questioned the Israeli military about the strike that killed the 10-year-old. In response, they stated that they were not aware of the incident. Israeli strikes also hit 3 buildings across the Gaza Strip after residents received evacuation warnings, as desperate families once again gathered what belongings they could and fled. Mothers reportedly carried babies as people rushed through the rubble. Elderly Palestinians escaped in wheelchairs or with canes as smoke rose over an already devastated landscape. The Israeli military said it also struck the Shati refugee camp in Gaza City and Deir Abalah after issuing warnings. Abu Ibrahim Eid, a resident, witnessed the strike.
We want to live in safety, to live our lives. Look at the house. This house is being destroyed as we speak because of the airstrike just a little while ago. They launched 4 missiles, and all this destruction is because of those missiles. The displaced people and their property, everything was destroyed. Now they are homeless, with nowhere to settle. Now they are wondering where to find a safe place to go.
These deaths are among the latest since an October ceasefire agreement that sought to halt more than 2 years of war between Israel and Hamas. Earlier this Monday morning, KPFA's Gaza correspondent Rami Al-Maghari updated our newsroom on the conditions on the ground, which he says appear to be escalating.
I feel so, absolutely, because the strikes have been in a few hours, but which might be an indication that there will be some kind of an escalation.
While Israeli attacks on Gaza have continued despite last October's ceasefire, Rami says the recent strikes appear to move further from peace.
Maybe this is related to political calculations, to elections that are upcoming in Israel. We don't know.
Rami's assertion was also echoed by Bassam Naim, a senior Hamas official who told CNN's Christiane Amanpour that the Board of Peace mediators and U.S. advisor Donald Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner have asked Hamas to, quote, be sensitive to Benjamin Netanyahu's political position ahead of Israel's upcoming election over the already agreed-upon Gaza roadmap.
According to the 15 roadmap plan, which is including clear paragraphs about personal individual weapons and other kind of weapons and decommissioning and the tunnels and workplaces and all these points, it has been clearly written in the plan how to do it. It is not my duty as a Palestinian to take care about the sensitivity of the timing of the deal that Netanyahu, because we have heard this from Mr. Kushner and the other members of the delegation, that you have to keep in mind that Netanyahu is now passing through a very delicate time. I am not in the position as a Palestinian to pay the price from the bodies and blood and the life of our people in order to secure the success or of victory of Netanyahu the election.
Regardless of the political motivations behind the escalation, Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir last week publicly called for killing, quote, 30 to 40 people in Gaza each night. According to Rami, Ben-Gvir was saying the quiet part out loud. Israeli attacks and civilian deaths have continued despite nearly a year of a so-called ceasefire, during which more than 1,200 Palestinians have reportedly been killed.
Has not ceased. Yes, even after reports about some kind of a close understanding or a close agreement on delivery, on handover of weapons, and Israel starting evacuating, but everything is stuck now. It's all stuck.
Our Gaza correspondent also noted the unusual focus on children's kites. An announcement, he says, in itself is another sign of escalation.
The kites that children fly, trying to fly in the sky, were banned by the Israeli army, the Israeli officials, and they warned against launching this kite. And evacuation orders will be issued for areas from which this kite could be launched by the children. And now no kite is being launched because the Israelis say that some of these kites landed in nearby Israeli towns near Gaza. So this is really strange and weird to ban such kites.
In 2018, during the Great March of Return, the Israeli military accused Palestinians of launching burning kites into southern Israel, setting approximately 6,000 acres of fields ablaze. The alleged attack took place amid mass protests against the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza. Israeli troops opened fire on demonstrators, killing more than 120 Palestinians and wounding approximately 3,800 others with live ammunition, the overwhelming majority unarmed civilian protesters. Now, Israeli officials are again expressing concerns after several kites were found in a kibbutz near Gaza. However, no weapons or dangerous materials were attached. And Israeli authorities are now threatening to intensify attacks unless Hamas ensures that kites stop flying towards Israel. Their announcement came during an evacuation order, which, according to Rami, continues to be issued in the war-torn enclave.
And there's still evacuation orders coming frequently. Yes, we hear about evacuation orders in other places. This is crazy.
And earlier this morning, Rami said the Israeli military had begun targeting additional civilian infrastructure, including a desalinization plant and an important cultural site.
As I am talking to you, oh my God, a mosque Prophet Abu Salim, one of the ancient mosques in Deir al-Bala, was just hit. Yes. Another mosque in Al Burej, in Gaza City also, a small mosque. Well, we don't know what's going on here now. It seems that this war never ends. This war never ends.
The Israeli government claimed that the attacks targeted a Hamas weapons storage facility inside the mosque. However, they did not provide evidence for that claim. In July, Hamas said it would begin disarming as part of the plan announced by President Trump, which also calls for Israel to end its attacks and withdraw from Gaza. But rather than withdrawing from positions along the so-called yellow line, Israeli forces have continued pushing the boundary farther into the besieged territory. The line now places approximately 60% of Gaza under Israeli control and deepening the stalemate of the proposed peace plan. Rami says he continues to witness Israeli military activity near the boundary. He says Israeli soldiers fire weapons at night, forcing Palestinians further away. And by the following morning, the yellow line has moved deeper into Gaza.
Yes, close to the east of the refugee population, where I live, in the Madazi in central Gaza Strip. I saw it with my eyes. Yes. We're on a small space of land, and now it's getting smaller than before, much smaller than before. It's very, very suffocating situation, strangulating situation, and getting further strangulating, further suffocating.
Regional powers and mediators have accused Israel of obstructing peace efforts after it rejected the proposed roadmap. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Board of Peace representatives last week, and officials expressed cautious optimism following the meeting, but announced no concrete commitments.
Whatever they speak is nonsense unless it is accompanied with some real actions on the ground. There needs to be some actions, because actions speak louder than words. And these countries absolutely might have some actions to take, but they don't take them.
With far less than the agreed-upon amount of aid reaching Gaza, medicine shortages worsening, and Israeli airstrikes continuing to kill civilians and children, Rami says the political football continues while Palestinians bear the consequences.
Having no assets, having no food, no food security, food insecurity, water insecurity, the basic needs are lacking. It is a very complicated situation that requires some genuine intervention by the parties concerned, those who are supposedly concerned about the stability and peace or calm in this part of the world. But I do believe that Gaza is being abandoned. The population of Gaza, who is a civilian population, which is a civilian population, it's unfair that they keep bearing the brunt of these political dialogues, controversies, and debates. There must be some kind of action to let these people feel some kind of calm, feel some kind of relief. It's never bearable. This suffering needs to stop. It's too much.
At stake are the lives of some 2 million people in Gaza. Rami called on Americans, whose tax dollars have helped fund Israel's campaign against the civilian population, to pressure President Donald Trump to use his influence over Israeli authorities. Trump has touted the ceasefire as the fulfillment of a campaign promise. Rami says the president must now make good on that promise by pressing Israel to move forward with the agreement's second phase.
That's what the American administration believes. So the people should ask their government, their administration, to push forward, to push for such a second phase of ceasefire, to move forward smoothly with the leverage that the United States has upon the state of Israel.
Rami has reported for KPFA and Pacifica for more than 20 years. Today, he is doing one of the world's most dangerous jobs, reporting from inside Gaza, where international journalists are still banned from entering, and as Palestinian media workers have been killed in record numbers with little accountability, despite the fact that intentionally targeting journalists is a war crime. Rami cautiously agreed to share his personal perspective for tonight's newscast, fearing the conditions may be worsening.
The main reason that makes me continue, despite the fact this is, as you described, the deadliest or the most dangerous job in the world, that's my job, that's my life, that's the one that makes me feel alive, the one that brings a bread to my children, the one that makes me feel some kind of social dignity. This is a part. But in the end of the day, we are the people of Gaza. Endure all of this fear, worry, and concern. Yes, and also the suffering. We want this to come end. We want this to come end. We, the population of Gaza, wants this to come end, to come to an end. And I believe that without real, genuine, concrete, diplomatic intervention by those parties concerned, this will not come. This end will not come. That's what I believe. We are helpless. We are helpless population. Believe me, that we need real help. Real help.
That was KPFA's Rami El-Maghari speaking to us on WhatsApp this morning.
Turkey has sought an international arrest warrant for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu through Interpol over Israel's armed attack against and subsequent jailing of activists aboard the Global Samud flotilla. Last May, headed to Gaza in international waters, according to a report from Al Jazeera. The flotilla of ships had sailed from Turkey and was attempting to deliver aid to Gaza. In a social media post, Turkey's Justice Minister Akin Gurlek said warrants had been issued on July 14th for Netanyahu and another suspect under charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and torture, and said Turkey will ensure Israel is held accountable. Turkey, a NATO member, has repeatedly called for international action against Israel for violations of international law, which Israel denies. France, Italy, and Australia have also launched judicial proceedings.
This is the Pacifica Evening News, broadcast on KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KFCF in Fresno. I'm Lauren Schmidt with Christina Onestad. We'll be right back.
Donate your used car, truck, or boat to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. It's an easy way to help support KPFK and receive a tax deduction. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. An operator will arrange a good time to pick up your vehicle. 877-KPFK-AUTO or go online to kpfk.org.
collapsed over the weekend. President Donald Trump today told Canadian leaders to fall in line or face consequences far worse than tariffs already imposed, and threatened new 50% tariffs on Canadian vehicles, auto parts, and steel. That's some $20 billion in Canadian goods. Canada's now set to announce retaliatory tariffs against the U.S. Tuesday tomorrow, escalating a trade fight, according to reports from the Associated Press, citing anonymous sources. After calling it a war, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said Saturday retaliation would target sectors including steel, dairy, appliances, agricultural equipment, pulp and paper, and electronics. Today, he said Canada will continue to look elsewhere to do its business.
Over the last year alone, Canada has signed more than 20 trade and security deals across five continents. We completed our most recent trade deal with the United Arab Emirates in a record 47 days. Canada is now the best connected economy in the world. Canadian businesses now enjoy tariff-free access to 1.5 billion consumers. Over the next 6 months, we will double that number through new trade deals with ASEAN and India. This fall, we will begin intense discussions with the European Union, the world's second largest economy.
Carney cast doubt on the U.S.'s dependability, saying Canada was finding reliable partners, quote, everywhere in the world, except in the United States and Russia, unquote. He accused Washington of trying to subordinate Canada and said U.S. trade demands had confirmed Canada's fears the U.S. was seeking to dismantle major Canadian industries. Ontario's Premier Doug Ford was less diplomatic. He told a radio station U.S. President Donald Trump could kiss his ass. He doubled down that sentiment today, speaking to a reporter.
Donald Trump could kiss your ass. Did the Prime Minister tell you to ask you to tone it down a bit?
No, he didn't. I'm not going to comment, but he wasn't against that. And I have a lot of real estate on my ass, so he has a lot of room to kiss my ass. So,
well done.
I just do. I'm a big dude. What can I say?
Speaking to the public, he also warned tariffs will hurt Americans.
We need to use Canada's many points of leverage to create maximum impact, targeting deep red states and making sure that America's economy feels the pain. And make no mistake, Americans are already feeling the pain, because President Trump's tariffs are nothing more than a tax on the American people, raising the cost of everything from homes to food.
The deterioration between the U.S. and its northern neighbor comes after Trump had previously threatened to make Canada a U.S. state, then imposed tariffs that the Supreme Court later overturned. Trump wrote on social media today, Canada's been ripping off the United States of America for years, criticizing what he called the country's ridiculously high tariffs on U.S. farmers. Carney said Washington's auto sector proposals would gradually have the effect of dismantling Canadian production. U.S. Trade Representative Jamieson Greer blamed Canada for walking out of trade talks and said it's about gaining access for American markets.
But for the U.S. small business, for the U.S. manufacturer, for the U.S. worker, you know, this is a way for us actually to try to get wine and spirits back on the shelves in Canada. It's a way to make sure that our small dairy farmers, who have had very limited access into Canada for a long time, so we're actually worried about our small businesses, to make sure they get the kind of access they need.
He said the tariffs that went into effect over the weekend only affect about 0.6% of Canadian goods. Trump's new threat of 50% tariffs on Canadian vehicles, steel, and auto parts would dramatically increase that percentage. Plants and suppliers in Ontario are tightly integrated with factories in Michigan and other U.S. states, with parts routinely crossing the border multiple times during production.
In the United States, tariffs are also elevating back-to-school costs nationwide. Danielle Smith reports.
Americans are facing much higher prices for everyday school supplies than they have in years past, according to new research. Some experts point to the Trump administration's tariffs on imported goods as a key factor. Tariffs announced by President Donald Trump on what he called Liberation Day in April 2025 affected imports from numerous countries. Rates began at 10% and at one point reached as high as 145% on some Chinese goods. Tiber Basidis with Georgia Institute of Technology says that school supplies such as paper items, pens, glue sticks, and computers tend to be imported, so just about everything will be more expensive than it was before the tariffs.
One way to think about what has happened in the last couple of years, you know, the inflation has come down a little bit, but if those prices haven't come down, it's because of the tariffs, because tariffs have been put in place and essentially kept prices higher than they otherwise would have been.
Pennsylvania recently joined a coalition of 25 U.S. states to sue the Trump administration over a new round of import taxes ranging from 10% to 12.5%. The states demand that these new tariffs be canceled and refunded. The new tariffs, according to the lawsuit, affect more than 99% of products brought into the U.S. A new analysis by Groundwork Collaborative, an economic policy think tank, shows lunchboxes cost an average of nearly $19 this year, a more than 26% increase over last year's average. Notebooks are running $5, a sizable bump over the $4 average price recorded in 2025. Rudy Lushner with Rutgers University says stores have learned to expect a shifting trade environment.
Everything that came in went through the new tariff regime. So there's also no surprises at this point, because retailers, to the extent that they could raise prices, they've done that.
The Groundwork Collaborative analysis shows that overall back-to-school prices are 8% higher than they were last year. They estimate the average family will have to spend an extra $175 on supplies. This story was produced with original reporting from Will Fritz for the Pennsylvania Independent. For Keystone State News Connection, I'm Danielle Smith.
Vice President J.D. Vance was in Maine today as part of his recent GOP tour to tout a construction renaissance.
And as companies start building, orders for new factory machinery and other capital goods are breaking records. We're seeing the very foundation laid for a manufacturing renaissance all across this country. Where previous generations of Washington leadership would reward the people who are shipping factory jobs overseas, we are rewarding factories and manufacturers right here in Brewer, Maine, like Compotech.
He spoke in Ohio Friday with the same message, though some experts report the credit goes to former U.S. President Democrat Joe Biden, who signed the Inflation Reduction Act and CHIPS Act that spurred the boom.
In Ukraine, the country has marked its 35th anniversary of its independence. The UN Security Council again took up the issue of the escalating conflict in Ukraine, brought on by Russia's invasion in 2022. The UN says July was the deadliest month since the first year of the war. KPFA's Max Pringle reports.
The Security Council's European members called for the special Security Council meeting. They're calling for an immediate ceasefire and a negotiated settlement to the conflict. Ukrainian UN Representative Andriy Melnyk condemned what he called an unacceptable escalation of the conflict by Russia.
We strongly condemn Russia's escalating attacks. Attacks against civilians, civilian objects, and Ukraine's critical energy infrastructure constitute grave violations of international humanitarian law and must cease immediately.
According to the UN, 437 civilians were killed in Ukraine in Russian drone and missile strikes on mostly civilian infrastructure. More than 2,000 people were injured. In Russia, 67 people were killed in Ukrainian strikes. Denmark's Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen was in New York to make the case against Russia's escalation of the conflict.
This senseless war and the immense human suffering could end immediately. Russia simply needs to accept the unconditional ceasefire that Ukraine and the international community has been calling for over a year and a half now.
Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, said Ukraine's European allies are prolonging the conflict by arming Ukraine. He spoke through an interpreter.
It's particularly ironic that representatives of those states that have been arming Ukraine for years, consistently turning it into an instrument of military political pressure to be exerted on Russia, and encouraging Kiev's refusal to implement the previously reached Minsk agreements, and happily watching in impatient anticipation, anticipating the strategic defeat of Russia. They are trying to act as the main champions of peace.
UN officials and several UN diplomats said Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and other parts of Ukraine in 2014 and its full-scale 2022 invasion are the reason for the ongoing conflict. Rosemary DiCarlo is the United Nations Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs.
Today marks 4.5 years since the Russian Federation launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in blatant violation of the Charter of the United Nations and international law. For 4.5 years, this war has brought death, destruction, and displacement on a devastating scale.
DiCarlo called on the international community to step up aid efforts ahead of the approaching brutal Ukrainian winter. She also called for the sides to cease attacks on civilian aid operations. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
UK Prime Minister Andy Burnham made his first overseas trip today since taking office, joining other European leaders. They pledged further military and financial support for the country. Meanwhile, Ukrainian strikes have targeted Russian facilities, killing 3 teenagers and wounding 6 children.
A coalition of researchers, lawmakers, and community members is mobilizing to stop the Trump administration's closure of the San Francisco and Chicago branches of the National Archives and Records Administration, or NARA, in 2 Democratic-run areas. Congressman Kevin Mullen, a Democrat who represents the area south of San Francisco, held a press conference today to unveil new legislation requiring Congress be consulted on any changes. The Trump administration claims it needs to cut costs, but critics say the move will essentially deep-six a vast trove of hundreds of thousands of historical records, many of them key to the history of people of color and immigrants. Grant Dinn, communications co-chair of Save Our National Archives, says his group has collected over 8,000 signatures demanding the American people have access to their records and history.
These are files that are, deal with the Chinese exclusion, Asian exclusion in general, as well as Native American records and a lot of materials for people of color. And so if you look at the kind of pattern of what's happened, it's definitely consistent with other efforts to reduce spending on history and things like telling the National Park Service they can't talk about what happened to people of color. Right now, the reason why this is all, we're all up in arms is that the acting archivist had, just unilaterally decided to close these Chicago and San Francisco, which is in San Bruno, the 2 sites. So it was just very arbitrary.
In addition to key documents in Japanese American and Asian American history, the San Francisco Archives records include important materials on West Coast German and Italian Americans who were jailed in a little-known World War II concentration camp in Pacifica called Sharp Park. Last week, 36 Congress members sent a letter to the Trump administration objecting to the closures.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta has canceled a settlement meeting with Paramount scheduled for today. He's accusing the company of leaking and misrepresenting details of an earlier negotiation session. That's according to reporting from CNN. Today's meeting was supposed to be an early step towards a settlement of the California lawsuit seeking to block the merger between Paramount and Warner Brothers. Bonta is leading a 12-state coalition seeking to halt the merger, which they argue would impact entertainment industry workers and limit consumer choice. An antitrust trial in federal court is scheduled for next March. Paramount has argued the merger is pro-competitive, and opposition to it is politically motivated.
East Bay Congresswoman Latifah Simon has announced more than $800,000 for the redesign of the Ashby BART Plaza in Berkeley, a project she says will help address historic injustices. KPFA's A.V. Benford reports.
Standing near the Ashby BART entrance, in the shadow of the Ed Roberts campus, Congresswoman Latifah Simon told a crowd of city officials and neighbors that Washington is sending home $850,000 for a new public plaza here as a part of a larger $11 million package she's brought to the East Bay this year.
My job is to keep federal resources flowing into California's 12th district, and I will be coming back week after week, hopefully with good news, even in a Republican trifecta.
BART used eminent domain to build the Ashby Station in the early 1970s, displacing a predominantly Black South Berkeley neighborhood. It's a wound this corridor has carried for two generations, and past attempts to right the wrong have failed.
In the last two generations, we know the story, and we're here to tell the story. It was cut in half when our foremothers and fathers built this system. Black families by the thousands were lost. They were displaced. Black families and their businesses were decimated in South Berkeley. Folks lost their homes, but we lost so much of the culture that made this great district what we know it to be. So this project, including 600 homes, half of them permanently affordable, will also host the flea market.
A 2005 push for housing on the same lot collapsed the following year after the city lost a state planning grant. Simon thanked a long list of people standing behind her, including Berkeley Mayor Adina Ishishi, and the city's brand new public works director, Jamie Parks, on the job less than a week. She also credited BART's safety ambassador and Berkeley's community violence prevention staff. District 3 BART director, Barnarly Ghosh, who is familiar with the site's planning, says the goal is bringing back what the neighborhood lost.
What that means, it's welcoming back people who may have been priced out of the neighborhood. We're also going to see community spaces at the ground level that will hopefully make space for community businesses to, you know, so you can get on board and immediately see what kind of things are part of this community.
Ghosh says street realignment will be designed to make crossing Adeline safer for pedestrians and cyclists. The tour ended at the African American Cultural Center, a space Simon says she hopes one day can rival San Francisco's Fillmore District as a hub of Black culture. For now, the $850,000 is just for design. The bigger question, whether this corner of South Berkeley gets the housing, the plaza, and the flea market back the way the officials are promising, is still years from an answer. Construction is expected to begin in 2029. Reporting from South Berkeley, I'm A.V. Benford.
Water from the Colorado River watershed makes life possible across the Southwest. It supplies more than 5 million acres of farmland, 30 tribal nations, and three of the country's largest cities, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Phoenix. The river serves roughly 40 million people across 7 U.S. and 2 Mexican states. Its vast water system is governed by a complex collection of laws, treaties, and agreements, known collectively as the Law of the River, and overseen by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. Federal guidelines adopted in 2007, not the original 1922 Colorado River Compact, expire at the end of this year, with states and other stakeholders unable to agree on a new plan. The Bureau has proposed its own options for dividing the dwindling river's water. Vic Bedoyan reports from Fresno.
The Colorado River is in crisis. Its two major reservoirs, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, have fallen to historic lows amid a quarter-century mega-drought. But the seven basin states, tribal nations, and other water users have yet to agree on how to share the river's shrinking supply. That's the context for the Bureau of Reclamation's final environmental impact statement on future Colorado River operations. It lays out options for managing the river while leaving room for stakeholders to reach an agreement. Dr. David Rosenberg is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Utah State University. He said the Colorado River operations are extremely complicated.
One of the most important things of this new environmental impact statement is defining the minimum levels that we're going to draw down, or that we can draw down Lake Powell and Lake Mead to. And those levels are going to continue to generate hydropower. And I think that's a really, really important feature of this new framework, this new agreement, and that's going to have a lot of benefits throughout the system.
The new guidelines could bring painful cuts for the lower basin states of Arizona, Nevada, and California, reducing water supplies for cities, farms, and ranches as the river declines. Most of the Colorado River's water comes from snowpack and runoff in the upper basin states of Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. Under the 1922 compact, the upper and lower basins were each allocated 7.5 million acre-feet of water a year. But the upper basin generally uses less water than the lower basin and wants to protect its water supply for future growth. Sarah Porter directs the Kyle Center for Water Policy at Arizona State University.
We really need to figure out a way collectively to be reducing demand in the Colorado River by at least 3 million acre-feet out of the 15 million. And that probably can't all fall on the lower basin. The lower basin didn't agree to be junior to the upper basin.
Dr. Rosenberg says the Bureau's planning was informed by extensive research and scientific modeling. Its final analysis presents several alternatives, with the agency's preferred approach calling for coordination among the basin's water users.
Reclamation has put out state-of-the-art science, which includes the hydrology. And the hydrology is declining. It's also variable. And that information being out there can help clarify and put into perspective what maybe needs to happen.
Porter, however, says the new plan is unlikely to bring the competing parties closer together and could instead push them further from consensus.
We could look at all of the measures that have been taken in the last 25 years, including the 2007 guidelines, the drought contingency plan, some of the additional lower basin commitments to leave water in Lake Mead. Those different agreements are revisiting the Colorado Compact. We are in for a lot of legal conflict. And meanwhile, we don't have good reason to hope that hydrology is going to bail us out.
Dr. Rosenberg agrees that extreme climate conditions will make water supplies more vulnerable, hurting all users, but leaving California and Arizona to absorb some of the largest cuts. California has already agreed to temporary reductions aimed at preserving water levels in Lake Mead.
The shortages, the reductions from the legal entitlements are going to be quite large, particularly at low flows and at low reservoir storage. And everyone is going to be feeling the effect of that.
Sarah Porter says that while the Bureau's plan provides a framework for operating the river system, it falls short of bringing the competing parties together.
It doesn't place the basin on a path to stabilizing the system at all. It's really sort of tells how we'll manage things when they get really bad, as they are right now. And there are some parts that discuss what to do if we have a gloriously wet year, but it's really about, how do we keep managing a system that's on the edge.
The Bureau of Reclamation acknowledges that developing new guidelines is difficult in such a complex landscape, with critically low water levels in Lake Powell and Lake Mead, wide variations in river flows, and the expectation of drier conditions in the future. Those stressors complicate the task of balancing the impacts of water delivery reductions with the need to maintain reservoir infrastructure.
Anti-democratic forces are on the move around the world, and LGBTQ rights are their first target. From anti-gay propaganda laws in Russia to anti-trans measures here in nearly every U.S. state, the right is demonizing queer people and breaking democratic norms. Tune in to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine, Mondays at 7:30 p.m. following IMRU, or online at This Way Out. Discover the heart of the global queer community.